This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Do my best Paul Revere here. The QR codes are coming. The QR codes are coming. Okay. Actually, maybe more accurately, they're already here. You've seen them. They're those squares, those little digital squares. They're on smartphones. You scan them. You get a quick response barcode that can be used for just about anything. And maybe soon here in the Commonwealth, they can be used to show your vaccination status.
Says it's a universal standard, and we've been working with a bunch of other states. There's probably 15 or 20 of them to try to create a single QR code that can be used for all sorts of things.
Governor Baker there earlier this week on GBH. His office did clarify that this won't be required. And he doesn't support requiring businesses to scan for vaccine status. Still, how would it work and how are businesses responding? We're going to dive into that, beginning with WBUR business reporter Yasmeen Ammer. Yasmeen, welcome back.
Thank you, Tiziana. It's nice to be back.
So let's do the basics on QR codes for folks. I'm most familiar with them when I use my phone at a restaurant to scan one of those digital squares and it brings the menu up on my phone. How prevalent are they already?
So QR codes are a pretty old technology, actually, as far as technology goes. It's from the 90s, which is just ages ago. So it works much like a barcode. Like you said, you scan it with your phone, and then it's able to translate those weird little squares into something that you can actually understand. But the pandemic really pushed us to use this 90s technology in new ways because it's contactless. You said you've seen them at restaurants. Many restaurants don't even have a physical menu anymore, like you said. They just, you can order, you can pay. It's just really an easy way to communicate digitally.
So for something as important as a medical record, stakes seem different there. Is this really coming? I mean, I will say I actually have one for my vaccination status in my Apple Wallet. How close are we to everybody doing this?
So Boston Children's Hospital is a really good example of an entity that really capitalized on the QR code early on in the pandemic. They've used them to exchange sensitive information between doctors and patients, and they already actually have that vaccine QR passport in place. And the technology they used and helped create actually set the foundation for states like California and now our own Massachusetts. And there are at least 15 states looking to have this digital vaccine passport. So it's slowly rolling out, but it's really unclear on a timeline. But I do want to be clear about this. QR codes, like this vaccine record we're talking about, contains a limited amount of information. It's your name, your birthday, where and when you were vaccinated, and that is it. It's not tracking you. It doesn't know about those shoes you bought last week. It doesn't know other health information, so it cannot share it with other people. And that's really important to note because it's just designed to share the necessary information, nothing more.
Okay, in a minute, I'm going to bring in another voice. But before I do want us to be really clear, Yasmeen, there is a difference between having the option to show you're vaccinated this way and being required to show you are vaccinated. Let's talk about that difference.
Yeah, because Governor Baker's office really made it clear that this is not a vaccine mandate. This is just another tool in the toolbox for people who don't want to carry around that flimsy piece of paper or vaccine card. Many of you probably already lost it, to be honest. Or it's for businesses who decide to use it to ask for proof of vaccine. It doesn't go so far as like New York City, which demands proof of vaccine if you want to go to a restaurant or a gym, any indoor activities. So it doesn't go that far, but it is a step.
And how about security? I mean, this is private information.
It is private information. And like I said, it's like the key here is the QR code is really built on sharing only the information that you're going to need to, you're just going to need to tell somebody that you are vaccinated. You're not going to need to tell them what happened in that physical, the last physical you had. And so there are technical guardrails to prevent people from accessing that information.
Glad to hear that. All right. So let's talk about implementation at businesses. What are you hearing from them?
So it is up to businesses. So for so many of them, it's been really nerve-wracking. They've had to play that enforcer role if they do demand vaccines. And really, this news matters to the people who've already been demanding vaccines. And so, one of those people is Tracy Chan, who she owns Pagu in Cambridge. And she's demanded to see proof of vaccination for a long time. And she says that this is something that's really going to help her. It's sending a major message from our government.
That takes the pressure again off of us as a small business and off of our hosts and our managers at the front door who are checking vaccination and checking temperatures. It also just, I think, sends a different message from above that, hey, we do care about public safety and this is how we care about it. And this is how everyone can equally care about it by implementing this system.
Yeah, so for Tracy Chang, it's really about messaging. But like going back, it's also important technically, because I also spoke to Sam Treadway. He owns Back Bar in Somerville, and he's been requiring vaccines to enter his bar since this summer. So take a listen to what he's been having to deal with.
It is amazing how many people just stare at me blankly and say, well, what do you even mean? What do you mean proof of vaccination? How would I possibly show you that?
That cracked me up, Yasmin. You can hear him reflecting the confusion that customers have had when they're like, wait, I don't even know how to do that.
And it's because, you know, people have lost their papers. People don't even know sometimes that you can get papers. I almost forgot mine until somebody flagged me. It's like, oh, you need this piece of paper after I got my vaccine. And so the idea here is to have something that, again, sends the message that this is out there. And so that you don't have to look at somebody like they're from outer space when they ask you to show proof of vaccination.
Okay, Yasmin, I'm going to ask you to stand by. We're going to stay on this thread about businesses. I'm bringing in another voice, Jim Rooney, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. Jim, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jim, I'm assuming, and I should check this assumption with you, that businesses will like this idea and want there to be some sort of universal way to provide digitally your proof of vaccination. Am I wrong to assume that?
Well, I think businesses will like the tool and the option of doing it. Many of the major employers around Greater Boston will take advantage of it because it's a 21st century tool. I mean, as you mentioned, we use QR codes, sometimes downloading restaurant menus. But, you know, more than that, we use our phones for airline tickets, sporting tickets, all in all sorts of ways to enable something to take place more efficiently. And for those companies that are requiring people who enter their buildings or their workplaces to demonstrate proof, it's quite easy to do. Everyone that that taps their credit card or downloads a restaurant menu knows that there's a lot of good efficiency in QR codes.
So, Jim, I will get to policy in a second, but does this cost business owners? Is this something where the cost is on sort of the medical provider side, or do businesses have to invest in some way financially for this technology in order to be able to take advantage of it?
Well, there's probably some reader technology that's necessary, but if you go into many office buildings downtown Boston now, there's some ID type of system. We have one in our office building on Franklin Street in Boston that we have to scan. It may be a little bit different. Maybe they can take advantage of the current technology using it a different way, and there might be some minor investment, but I can't imagine it's extraordinary.
Are there equity concerns with this at all? If a business really wants to be able to make this a part of how they operate, but maybe they're cash strapped, maybe it's a small business, any concerns that this leaves some out in the cold?
I don't think businesses will make it the requirement. I think if they're requiring proof of vaccination and people don't want to take advantage of the technology, they'll allow them to show their paper card. I don't think you'll see a you must do it via this technology. I just think it'll be just like airline tickets and ballpark tickets that, you know, you may do it digitally or you may print it out.
Okay, so that then takes us to the policy side. And what I'm thinking about, I remember summer of 2020, we heard from a lot of business owners, for example, Jim, that it was easier to be able to say they had to ask you to wear a mask versus we as a private business are asking you to wear a mask. Where is the chamber? Where are your member businesses on whether or not this ought to be mandated, whether that's at a municipal level or a state level?
Well, the chamber has supported the actions of the Baker administration in not imposing a vaccine mandate and enabling municipalities at one level and individual businesses and venues at another level to create their own policies. And, you know, if you look at the bottom line in terms of effectiveness, Massachusetts is leading the country in terms of vaccination rates and rates among the top states in terms of incidence of COVID. So while one can, you know, maybe question whether or not it could have been done differently, I think the proof of the effectiveness is in the bottom line. Now, that said, you know, I do agree with you that there is a convenience if a business wants to do it but wants to blame government for making them do it. You know, that reality exists. But that said, Governor Baker didn't do it, and many employers in the chamber and in our membership imposed their own vaccine requirement. They said, you know, if you're going to come back to work, you have to show proof of vaccination or apply for a medical or other type of exemption. So they did it on their own, and I haven't heard a great deal of difficulty. I'm sure there were some, but I haven't heard a great deal of difficulty with that.
All right. That is Jim Rudy, President and CEO of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. Thanks, Jim. Okay, so I think we said goodbye to Jim. WBUR's Yasmeen Ammer is still here. Let's get reactions to what we just heard from Jim Rooney, Yasmeen.
Yeah, a couple things. One is that idea of convenience, like our business is going to be able to adapt to this technically. I think what we've seen from the pandemic is just so many of them have already had to make technical implementations that they've never had to do before. A lot of them are already scanning QR codes. And like I said, this is not really that new of a technology. You can even download an app to just do it on your phone. It's pretty simple. And so I think like the adaptation is not so much the issue. I honestly think the second thing Jim said that made me think of just how many businesses, the stress of just having to make those decisions. And the businesses that I spoke to, especially small businesses, just going back and forth of like, do we do this? Do we put vaccine mandates? What do our vaccine mandates look like? Do we do masks? It's just because, you know, we really haven't had anything that's streamlined either federally or locally. So it's kind of been hard on them.
All right. That is WBUR business reporter Yasmeen Ammer. Always great to have you. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Okay, so I want you to imagine you are trying to open a business, like it's your dream coffee shop or corner bodega. You've got your inventory, you got a location picked out, layout planned, but then you approach the city or the town to get started and they present you with an expensive and maybe impossible choice. Pay us huge fees or find somewhere else. That is reality for recreational marijuana shops since voters legalized pot in 2018. Cities charge these fees. They're called community impact fees, and they get to because they have these agreements with the businesses that are called host community agreements, and they are causing a lot of friction. So, for example, HVV is Cape Ann's first recreational marijuana dispensary, and they are now suing the city of Gloucester about these fees and asking for a refund. It's actually the second suit. We covered another one in Haverhill several months ago here on Radio Boston, and there are those who say there's more pushback on the fees and the agreements coming. So we're going to dive into that a little bit more. You may remember Shalene Title. She is a former commissioner for the state's Cannabis Control Commission and a drug policy lawyer with the Drug Enforcement and Policy Center at The Ohio State University. Shalene, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So there's a lot of nuts and bolts here. We will dive into that in a minute. But for now, is this criticism appropriate? Are host community agreements unfair, or are they getting a bad rap?
It's absolutely appropriate. And especially now that we have multiple years of data showing that there really is no cost to a municipality for having one of these businesses there.
And so let's talk about that cost thing, because that's what we mean with the community impact fee, right? The idea was, hey, marijuana business, having you in our community is going to cost us impact that costs us money, and we want you to pay for it, right?
That's exactly right. But it's important to note that the law is very clear that the fee has to be related to actual costs, and those costs have to be documented. And the law even goes as far as to say that those documented costs are a public record. So in other words, it sends a very strong signal that if a municipality is charging these fees, they should expect it to be scrutinized and they should be able to justify it.
And the issue has been, let's stay with these nuts and bolts. So the business signs a host community agreement with the city or town where they kind of lay all this out. This is how this is going to work. And the issue has been, in many cases, not only that the city or town isn't providing proof that we need this money, but that they're also layering on a lot of other fees or costs that may not be legit or at least provided for, you know, within the regulations. Is that fair?
Yes, that's correct.
How'd we get here?
Well, I think it started with a few cities engaging in this practice, and it started with some uncertainty where they said, you know, sincerely or not, they said, we don't know what the costs are going to be. So therefore, you have to charge us the entire maximum limit of 3% of your revenue. And then they were never able to justify those fees by showing any actual costs. So the way we got here is there are now lawsuits that are saying, okay, justify the fee by showing us the costs. And some municipalities don't have any documentation at all. Some have, for example, in Haverhill, 6 new police officers, 2 cruisers, gear, the DARE program. In Gloucester, they have justified the fee with actual negotiation expenses for the city for actually negotiating this contract. And so it's really unclear what the actual costs are to a municipality to have a business there.
All right, let's talk about some of these tensions. I'm going to start. We reached out to both Gloucester and to HVV, which is the marijuana business suing Gloucester. Understandably, since they are engaged in a legal battle, they weren't coming on air. They did both submit statements. We'll have full statements on our website. I'm going to give just a sampling from each. Gloucester's statement, in part, quote, "The city has complied and always will comply with the law. As a result, we believe that we will ultimately be successful in our defense in this case. Having said that, we will not comment any further on pending litigation." Then a little bit from HVV, quote, "This is an important lawsuit which simply seeks to force the city to comply with the law. The legislature set clear limits on permissible host community impact fees and required that they be tied to real impacts. Unfortunately, some municipalities saw this as an opportunity for a money grab instead. We hope this lawsuit will remedy this situation." Now, Shalene, bear with me for a second. I want to focus on that money grab. We did speak again with the founder of STEM, Caroline Pino. We've spoken with her before. She sued her host community in Haverhill for similar reasons. And when she talked to us, she said that marijuana businesses have had more positive impacts on communities than negative.
We need to look at the facts that there's been no sales to minors. There's been no increases in crime around cannabis facilities. There's been no decrease in home or business values due to the presence of legal cannabis. There have been no reported increases in driving while intoxicated by cannabis. There has been 17,000 new jobs and $200 million in new state and local tax revenue that's never existed before. And so I think that, you know, all of those things are so positive, and we need to start talking about the positive and, you know, not creating this unnecessary fee and burden for, especially for independent operators.
Again, Carolyn Pino there, founder of STEM, the marijuana business in Haverhill, who sued the city. So that argument, is that on the upward trend here as we have more years of recreational marijuana businesses in cities and towns under our belts, Shalene?
It is, and it's really what the data supports. And in fact, we now have multiple cities, Northampton and Lee, that have stopped charging community impact fees because they say they don't have any basis for them.
Okay, and I do want to note producer Amanda Beland reminding me that suit is still ongoing and Haverhill as well. So this is interesting. We also discovered that there are some communities, Shalene, beginning to make changes. Earlier this year, both Northampton and Lee removed 3% community impact fees for their marijuana operators. We spoke with Patricia Carlino, chairwoman of the Lee Board of Selectmen earlier about this. This is what she said about removing the fee for the business Canna Provisions.
After 2 years, we had pretty much come to the conclusion that we didn't have any impact. You know, when they first passed the law and everything sounded wonderful, and nobody knew what would the impacts be. But there really haven't been any. It's kind of hard to identify any impact from this business that worked negatively to the town.
So obviously there's a theme going on. You were talking about this, Shalene, then we heard it from Caroline Pino. Now we hear it from the town of Lee. Is this the right way to go? Are we at a point where not only are we getting pushback, but cities and towns should be removing these fees and community impact agreements?
Yes, and I would go even further. I think the legislature should consider removing this requirement altogether, because not only is it not justified, it's really harming small businesses and the economic empowerment businesses that our state was supposed to encourage. And it unfairly benefits the businesses that can afford to pay any fee.
Yeah, I want to stay with that. And we've talked with you extensively in the past, Shalene, here on the air, about the equity dimensions of cannabis law in Massachusetts. I mean, I think it makes sense to go back and remind everyone, when marijuana was legalized for recreational use in the Commonwealth, the thought was to design the policy such that those communities and individuals who had been most negatively impacted by marijuana policy in the past stood best to benefit from this growing industry. And that has not played out, Shalene. Talk about that.
It has not played out to my satisfaction, but I would say that we are seeing very steady progress, and the commission continues to report data and to make changes. Most recently, they actually decided to proactively ask the legislature to create a social equity fund so that some of these businesses can have capital. That's one of their top barriers, in addition to the host community agreement. And so we still have a chance. I think the window is not yet closed to make this a fair and equitable industry that is welcoming to small businesses.
Well, and we know the money's been a rate limiting factor. I want to go back to Caroline Pino of STEM in Haverhill again. That same conversation, she told us that fees are negatively impacting the people the industry was most designed to support. Here she is.
The barrier of entry, the capital required to open an operation, a retail establishment, a grow facility, a manufacturing license, is so exorbitant that it's a huge barrier of entry for social equity applicants, people of color, people from disproportionately harmed communities by the war on drugs. These fees are creating a pay-to-play market, unfortunately and sadly.
So first, is it a pay-to-play system, Shalene?
Absolutely. At this point, yes.
So what do we do about that?
Well, removing the host community agreement and community impact fee would be a great start. And then at this point, there are many other states that have created ways to offer financing through grants and loans. There's a lot of models that we could use. And so those two things are very rational, common sense, evidence-based steps we could take at this point.
And we are the only state that has this kind of community impact fee and host community agreement set up, correct, Shalene?
Yes, that's correct.
So as I understand it, and this is the last sort of technical piece, the commission, the Cannabis Control Commission, doesn't have the authority to change this. You've alluded to this. This has got to be the legislature, yes?
I actually disagree, but that's
okay.
The commission's position, yes.
Okay. Can you talk a little more about that?
Well, I think that the commission could actually review these host community agreements and could have been doing so from the beginning. But the commission's vote was that it wanted clarity on that, and it asked the legislature to give them clarity, to give them authority. And so there was a bill to do that. It passed the House last session. currently it was introduced again, and now it's in the Joint Committee on Cannabis. So it's moving along slowly.
Do you believe we'll get there?
Yes, I do. And thank you for calling attention to all of this.
Well, I appreciate that. So we have just a little bit of time. Where do you get that optimism from?
Well, people have been telling us for 20 plus years that marijuana legalization would never happen and the big companies wouldn't let it happen. And we've absolutely seen it happen because the people want it. So if the people want this to be equitable, we can make that happen as well.
And that is Shalene Teitel, former commissioner for the Cannabis Control Commission here and a drug policy lawyer with the Drug Enforcement and Policy Center at The Ohio State University. Shalene, always good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. You too.
Let's celebrate some jazz and all of those who make it. We would like to revisit now a recent conversation with Terry Lynn Carrington, renowned jazz drummer and a consultant for the Pixar movie Soul. You remember Soul, right? That is music by Tia Fuller, as played by animated saxophonist Dorothea Williams in the film. And if you haven't seen it, Dorothea leads her band, the Dorothea Williams Quartet, and helps main character Joe pursue his dream of performing jazz on stage. Works great for the plot. But the reality is, female jazz musicians are still relatively rare compared with their male counterparts. And oftentimes, even if women are on the stage, they're on an island surrounded by men. Terry Lynn Carrington knows this dynamic well as a jazz musician herself, but she and others are looking to change that status quo with a new program at the Berklee College of Music. The Next Jazz Legacy aims to mentor and nurture young women and non-binary jazz musicians. Their inaugural class launches this winter, and Carrington, the founder of the Berklee Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice, is the program's chair. When we caught up with Terry Lynn Carrington last month, I started by playing a bit of her own music when she was the house drummer for the Arsenio Hall Show. It's a cover of Blackbird by the Beatles. So I wanted to play that for you because in watching the video, Terry Lynn, you are a woman in almost entirely surrounded by men. Talk about that, this place of women in jazz.
Well, that's been the case throughout my whole career. I got my union card when I was 11 or 10, no, 10, I think, here in Boston. And I'm 56, so I've had 46 years of professional drumming so far. And it's always been dominated by men. And I just took that as the way it is, and I accepted it, and I thought that was normal. And about 5 years ago or so, I started really feeling like we needed to make more space, you know, not in a couple of years, not 10 years down the line, but right now. And that's when I started the Institute at Berklee. But this program is a partnership with New Music USA, and Vanessa Reed, who's the president and CEO of New Music USA, we've been concocting this for about a year and a half, and, you know, very pleased with the fact that we're able to do it through the funding of Mellon Foundation, and will affect at least 20 young women and non-binary performers within the next 3 years.
So, you know, I know a study done by NPR Music Jazz Critics poll in 2019 showed that fewer than 16% of artists on jazz records were women, for example. What will this program do for upcoming jazz artists who are women, who are non-binary, to help change the landscape of the genre?
Well, I think we'll draw more attention to the fact that young women and non-binary artists need to be mentored more and have these types of apprenticeship situations to really get their playing on the level that they want it to be. Because often what happens is women end up playing together because that's the community they're in, and they're not able to necessarily always break through with some of the male colleagues that they want to play with, or their people they look up to, so they end up playing together or becoming band leaders maybe a little too early before they're ready. Because I know that most of the people that I know that are great, they really studied under somebody. When I say study, I don't mean at a school. I mean on stage, traveling, learning on the job. And that's really the only way you can learn how to play jazz. So this program is to help these 20 women that will affect in the next 3 years, help them find apprentice situations.
I want to talk a little bit more about that apprenticeship. You know, I feel like in the last couple of years, especially in the wake of the hashtag MeToo movement, we've started to have a more in-depth conversation about both the experiences of women in the workplace, but also mentorship and what's been missing in bringing up the next generation. And now we're increasingly having that same conversation for members of the non-binary community, the LGBTQ community. How essential is somebody bringing you up to being able to take the next step in a career as just unbelievably competitive, I'm assuming, as jazz?
Yes, it's extremely competitive. And when young people graduate from college, if they go to college, you don't have to have graduated from college to be in this program. But when you do graduate and you go into the professional world, the competition is great. In fact, when I graduated, well, I didn't graduate from Berkeley, but when I left Berkeley in 1983, I think it was, 84, my mentor, Jack DeJohnette, he told me to go to New York and put myself in the environment where the competition is the greatest. And basically, I was sink or swim, but he was there to, you know, to help me. But he also told me that my competition was him and everybody else that played the drums, that, you know, lived in New York or that played jazz. So it is extremely competitive. And I feel like without these types of mentors and without apprenticeships, you don't really have the same chance. You know, you're not on the scene in the same way. You know, somebody has to show you the ropes. And that's how jazz has always been. And that's, you know, what the foundation of the music is, passed down from one person to another.
I'm going to play you a little more of your music again. This is from your record, TLC and Friends. You were 16. Here is La Bonita. Bear with me as I connect these dots, because I'm listening to this music you as a young person playing, and I'm thinking about newly elected Boston Mayor Michelle Wu last night in her victory speech, saying that her sons asked her, hey, can a boy run for mayor too? Which was a framework for them, because they only knew a girl running for mayor. Would your music then have been different in any way if you'd been seeing girls all around you?
Well, I'm not sure how different it would be, but I would suspect that it would be different, because I'm always compared to men. And as far as I was concerned, I had to play as good as the next guy. And that was what I tried to do. I didn't want anybody to say I played like a girl, because I would have taken that not as a compliment. Now I feel like we have to embrace our differences and be open to a possible different aesthetic in the music, based on our gender identity. And I was never open to that before. And now I am. So I try to embrace it within myself more. It worked out for me because I was a tomboy growing up, and I always wanted to, you know, play with the boys and play sports, even though I wasn't very good at it. But I wanted to do the things that the boys did. And I think some young women, you know, naturally aren't that way. And nor should they have to be able to make it in jazz.
Are there women or non-binary artists who have really influenced you?
Well, I believe in mutual mentorship. So my students influence me all the time. I have so many students that I learn from. I think it helps me to remain relevant. It keeps me up to date with what's happening and keeps my ideas fresh. So I would have to say yes, you know, to that in some ways. But just as far as, you know, my main influences, there weren't very many women at all, you know, while I was developing. So, you know, unfortunately, I don't have any mentors that were female.
And that's really what this is about, right? I'm 10 years from now, I get to talk to another jazz artist who answers that question differently.
Yes, that is exactly what it's about. But it's not women mentoring women. It's everybody mentoring women. So our band leaders will be both male and female, because a big part of this program is for the people that have benefited the most from, you know, oppressive structure that we've been dealing with. I mean, I think they have a real responsibility to help change it as well.
What are you hearing from musicians in the jazz community about this program? What's the response been?
Well, we just launched a couple of days ago, so I haven't heard a whole lot.
Early days.
Yeah, but I mean, in general, all the work that I do with the Institute has been embraced by most of my male colleagues. And I mean, what I find interesting is either people are progressive or they're not. And it often doesn't boil down to their gender, because there are women that they don't want to be a part of anything that is centered around women, because, you know, we've been trained well to think that that means it's not as good, or that we're bringing attention to the fact that women, and people, you know, will say to me all the time, I'm not a woman this or a woman that, you know, I'm just, you know, just a musician. Or I'm just, and I understand that, because that's how I felt. And that was my response as well years ago. But, you know, as I said, now I'm trying to embrace what might make me different and embrace all the sides of myself.
You mentioned, you know, founding Berklee's Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice. So let's fast forward 10 years. You're looking at jazz 10 years from now. You're thinking back on this week when you launched this program. How might music be transformed?
How might music be transformed? Well, I think the most important thing is that we're trying to transform the culture. You know, and I think the music will tell its own story, but we're trying to shift the narrative. And so far, that narrative has remained pretty heavily on men play the instruments and women sing. That's kind of in the unspoken narrative that I've seen in jazz. And you always have a few women that pop up that play great, but then there are the exceptions. And we're trying to, you know, make the, you know, help the culture change to not accepting that there are a few women that are exceptions. But we want to have women that are great, women that are mediocre, you know, all throughout the entire ecosystem.
That was Terry Lynn Carrington, chair of the Next Jazz Legacy and founder of the Berklee Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice at the Berklee College of Music. And let's hear just a bit more music by Terry Lynn. This is she with an accompanying all-female band covering the Mary Lou Williams song Pisces for the Library of Congress. Tonight is the fifth night of Hanukkah. It is a celebration of light in darkness. It's also one of many traditions that people in both faith and secular communities celebrate this time of year. And we were so hopeful that this year, this holiday season, things would be different. Or maybe that they wouldn't be different, that we would be back to normal. But we continue to live in the exception. So where do we find light in the darkness this year? With that question in mind, we called Rabbi Claudia Kramen, Senior Rabbi of Temple Beth Zion in Brookline. Rabbi, welcome back.
Thank you, Tiziana, for having me back.
Really wanted to talk to you. Hanukkah is a celebration of a story about turning darkness into light. And I think as the weather gets darker here, we were all hoping for more light in this season. And instead, it's starting to feel like here we go again. How are you feeling, and how's the season feeling to you?
Yeah, you know, a week ago, we would have had a very different conversation. And I'm hopeful that we can continue to hold into the light and the hope that there is possibility coming out of this soon, waiting to understand and learn how COVID and the new developments unfold. But in the meantime, even though it is not what we hope a year ago, that we will be back to full homes and houses and rooms of partying together and celebrating together. We are in a very different place from last year. And I think we can focus on our gratitude that we are in a different place, that it's not the same that last year. A year ago, everything was closed. I know that in our community, everything that we held last year was either virtual on Zoom, online, or outside in the really, really cold weather, bringing people to light the Hanukkah, the menorah, outside our building. And this year, we do have opportunities to come together in person safely, following strict guidelines that we have developed over the few months that we have been back together. So I would say I am still feeling the light and feeling the hope that it is a good season to celebrate, to encounter gratitude and hope that one every night it's a little bit more light out there. We can do that.
The Radio Boston community is a diverse community. We're religiously diverse. We have, you know, Catholics and Jewish worshipers, Muslims. We have secular humanists. We are a large community, and we can learn from each other's stories. So tell us what we can take from the Hanukkah story for all of us this season.
Wonderful. So the Hanukkah story, known to many, is a story. There are several stories, parallel stories. We don't have enough time for me to go into all the different layers of the story. The story that most people know and that we tell in the rabbinic lore of Jewish tradition is that when the Temple of Jerusalem was defiled, all what the people could find was very little oil to light the menorah. And that little oil that they thought it would last just one night lasted for 8 nights, and that was the miracle of Hanukkah. It is important to say, though, that that wasn't only the miracle of Hanukkah. That is one of the layers, a little bit of oil that lasted. The miracle of Hanukkah was also that a minority of people that were oppressed were able to free themselves and fight for their values and for what they believe and stand up for that and free other people. So they go one parallel to the other, the fact that light comes in the moments of darkness and that people can find redemption in times of darkness. You mentioned before that, you know, these holidays happen when the days are getting darker and darker. It's very hard. And what we do is in the season, not only Jewish practice, but all other holidays in this time is we light the light when it gets dark. We don't give up. We don't let darkness be what guide us in life. We let light guide us. Our practice is to light every night one more candle, adding to this possibility, this hope. What I love very much about this practice is that we say the blessing, we say two blessings every day, three the first day. And the second blessing we say it while lighting the candles. And the blessing we say is we bless that in Hebrew, Shasani Sim Lavoteinu Bayamim Ahem Bazman Hazeh, we bless that we had miracles, miracles were happened to our ancestors and on those times on and these times, which is a kind of a funny, strange blessing to say, because we say that miracles happen to those who came before us, but then we say then and now. And the recognition is that miracles happen all the time, but that the act of miracle happens when we hold a candle and we light that candle. They don't just happen. We need to have a hand in miracle making. And I think that is one of the teachings that we can hold into now. If we want a miracle for this hard time of the pandemic to end, we need to light that miracle. We need to get vaccinated and we need to put our mask on and we need to take responsibility for the parts of what we can do. It's not just going to happen. It is upon us to bring the light so we can be in a better place.
We have very little time, so I'm going to ask you for a blessing, a short one, a sentence that anybody could share with the people they love in their lives right now.
A blessing. I think the blessing I want us all to have, or I want to share with all of us, is that we have the capacity to hold into the light when it feels dark out there. To know that the darkest it gets, we are capable to light the road ahead of us. And that we recognize in us that potential of bringing that to the world. That we are the hand of God on bringing light and miracles. And that's my blessing for all of us to recognize and to bring to those around us.
That is Rabbi Claudia Kramen, Senior Rabbi of Temple Beth Zion in Brookline. Rabbi, thank you.
Thank you so much, Tiziana.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.